Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa.
Thanks for bringing us on the air, Mike. The rest of our Zoom team for today are Gina McAndrews and Paul Wearson, who are joining me in hosting today's show as we usher in December. And before we introduce our guests for today, I want to thank our listeners, especially those who contributed yesterday to Giving Tuesday. I was never aware of Giving Tuesday until this year, but Ursula said, be sure you thank our listeners. We got lots of mail yesterday.
Well, while we're on the subject of giving, KHOI has an online holiday gift fair auction. A big blue square right beneath the yellow Become a Member button on our website at khoifm.org. There are lots of interesting possibilities for holiday gifts. Pipes and jewelry and mugs and vases. All sorts of exciting things. We can talk about that later in the program, but that not right away. We don't want to slight our guests. All of you are bringing exciting announcements to end the year.
First, we'll have Betty Andrews, who has spoken with us this year as a president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP. We are especially happy today to announce that Betty has agreed to bring KHOI a monthly segment on social justice and civil rights. She has a long history of key roles in shaping governmental responses to a variety of issues, from prisons to education. In fact, I believe I saw a couple of front page or at least pictures of her with the governor when the governor signed the... What was it, Betty? You're there. What
was it? Sure. It was the felony reenfranchisement. So basically the right to vote for people with felony backgrounds. So really exciting moment. And we'll talk about that today.
Okay. So she's going to be with us. But I wanted to mention an especially exciting part of her biography. She had a substantial career in broadcasting, previously serving as public affairs director and talk show host for 3 Des Moines radio stations. Wow. I think that's pretty impressive.
Wow. And Betty Andrews is with us. We're excited.
Yes, indeed. Welcome, Betty.
So glad to be here. And just double checking, you would like me to go ahead and start, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, thanks so much. You know, it's new. We're kind of still figuring out the kinks and the quirks. And so I'm really glad to be able to be with you today. Thanks so much for the invitation, Susan, to be with you and your radio family. Yes, my background also in broadcasting is public affairs, so I'm really excited to be able to take part and share with you for about 10 to 15 minutes every month. And we will talk about a number of things, because when it comes to civil rights and social justice, the reality is that it does affect every area of our lives. I mean, it's about the pursuit of the American dream. It's about making sure that people are not discriminated against. It's about people ensuring that equity abounds. So that's why I'm here. That's also why I'm very excited to join you today. And I know that specifically, I wanted to just kind of jump in today to kind of take a look at the year 2020, and maybe even a little before, and talk a little bit about some of the significant civil rights and social justice movements of the past year. So it's okay if I do that, Susan?
Oh, it sure is. And
okay, well, if you all have questions or anything, feel free to jump in. Otherwise, you know, I'll have the conversation and we can certainly discuss it, or I can keep going. So, of course, when I think of this last year, one of the things that I always think about is that we're looking at a slice in time. So we may see things that have happened, but there are a lot of underpinnings when it comes to what we actually see. So what we're seeing this year, in many respects, is the tip of the iceberg. When it comes to the most significant civil rights or social justice event of this year, and I would actually say that there were two. I'd argue that there were two. One, of course, is the event that is plaguing, if I could use that word, all of us, and that's the pandemic. But when it comes to that event and the other event that I'm going to talk about, and then some of the other things, it's important to realize that those didn't happen in a vacuum, that these are things that you know, as I mentioned, are tips of the iceberg and have many underpinnings. So, of course, and when I think about civil rights over the last year or so, I am thinking about the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And that is an absolutely significant event that happened. His murder was unbelievable. And I know that a lot of people were angered by the situation. I know that a lot of people saw the injustice firsthand. And I understand that it pulled the covers off of what Black people and other people of color have been going through since the founding of this country. You know, many talk about 1619, when African Americans or Africans first reached this land, and not under their own will. So that event this year with George Floyd was significant, not just for the people who, you know, have been experiencing it. It was significant for the general public because it was undeniable. It was undeniable that something of this nature could happen, and that that there would be that much audacity to have a public lynching, if you will, for the world to see and to have that displayed in such a way. And the outrage was, it was people in the streets, but it was also people in positions and people that were able to make some changes. And I believe that's what we have been seeing over the last year. I will say, as a representative of the NAACP, that it is something that the NAACP has been working on since our founding in 1909. And even before that, the previous iteration of us, the Niagara Movement. So we've been working for some time on these events. And so bringing it back to the George Floyd death, the other significant part of that was just the acknowledgement of a civil rights tool that a lot of times people don't realize, and that's the cell phone. And that's our ability these days to be able to capture video. And so with that capturing of the video, it put front and center a tragedy that took place. And because that happened, again, I do want to emphasize that there were many people that took to the streets, but there were many people also that sat home and were shocked. There were many people that began asking, what can I do? There were many people who joined on social media that stepped forward to say, I want to do something. There were many people who came and joined the NAACP and requested assistance in helping how and guidance on how they could do some things. And so that brings us to Iowa. And in Iowa, you know, we definitely saw the protests, which were very important in making sure that issues stay front and center. They were extremely important in igniting the fire in new people, in the next generation of advocates. You know, we think about the Dr. Martin Luther Kings and people that had come before us in the civil rights movement of the 60s, the 50s and 60s before. I know myself, I wasn't around, but I know that that was important. So to be able to see that. And the interesting part of that also is that it was also something that we had kind of seen previous glimpses of. And I say glimpses, I don't mean to dismiss it, but with the death of Trayvon Martin, with the death of Sandra Bland, with the death of a number of other people. So this year we have also Ahmaud Arbery and so many others, and I'll even include my nephew in that, Emmanuel Ellis out of Tacoma, Washington. And so those were significant pieces. So I want to acknowledge that. But then also in the state of Iowa, just understanding again that we are addressing that iceberg piece. You have the NAACP who has been working for several years to address issues of disproportionality and racial challenge and lack of inclusion. And so one of the issues that we had been working on for quite some time was the right for people with felony backgrounds to vote. And that's important because your vote is your voice, and you have all of these people that may have made mistakes, but had paid their time and paid their debt to society and were coming out and were responsible for paying taxes and participating, and yet they were unable to have a voice or to have a vote. And so by them being unable to have a voice, it really did silence a significant number of our population. So for many people who don't know, the governor signed executive order number 7 on August 5th of 2020, which was powerful. And we can certainly talk about how that happened. But also, I just want to acknowledge that it was not the first executive order. There was an executive order previously, about 10 years prior, that was signed by Governor Vilsack. And the NAACP played a significant role in that. And through the challenges that we had with, and Governor Branstad revoked that order, the NAACP had been working with Governor Reynolds on signing it. We've been working with her on attempting to pass a state constitutional amendment and so forth. And to be able to work through that process took some time, and it brought us, it coincided with all the activities, the civil rights activities of 2020. So with the support of the community through the Black Lives Matter movement, with people making requests and pushing, and also our legislators pushing, people, not just Black people, but people of all hues wanting to see a change, we were able to work with the governor to negotiate Executive Order 7. And that was a huge victory for the NAACP. It was a huge victory for a number of other organizations, including many of the protesters that were stepping forward to support, that came in this year and actually in the last few months to give a significant push for the need for people to vote. And since then, thousands of people with felony backgrounds have been able to register and did vote in the general election. We also, the NAACP didn't stop there. We continued to work with the Secretary of State's office to ensure that their information that they were putting out was welcoming to those who were formerly incarcerated and that were able to vote. And of course, people who received their right to vote back included people who had served their time and also were off of parole and probation and had not committed a murder or related acts. And so that was significant because it didn't require people to pay a fine or pay a fee. So it was a significant point. Other significant social justice activities include the NAACP worked with several communities. We've been working on anti-racial profiling legislation for a number of years. We introduced the concept of that and had been working with the city council for about a year and a half officially. In Des Moines, we started at the state level and we continue to pursue at the state level. But we also said, you know what, let's start working with communities in order to get racial profiling or anti-racial profiling and unbiased policing ordinances passed around the state to kind of boost the support for the state legislation. And we began with a small town called University Heights. They passed an ordinance just this year. The city of Des Moines passed an ordinance, and that ordinance was, it was a process. It was a series of us turning down several poor ordinances that the city proposed and negotiating to the 11th hour to come up with a significant order. We certainly didn't get everything we want, but we did get a ban on racial profiling and on unbiased policing and also the duty to interfere and a number of other things in that ordinance. And so that also that led to several other ordinances in the works. Last night, as a matter of fact, I sat on Iowa City's city council meeting for the second time. They just had their second reading for their anti-racial profiling ordinance. So that's powerful. And then we also have the city of Coralville, who I think will go in next week, and a number of others that are on their tails. I do want to also say that another significant piece is that the NAACP worked with to appoint the governor's focus committee on criminal justice reform. Now, this is a state committee that worked together under the chairmanship of our lieutenant governor, and the NAACP played a significant role in order to go through thoroughly unbiased policing and racial profiling and also reentry issues. And through the recommendations of that committee, we have been able to secure some strong recommendations going into this session on unbiased policing and anti-racism and recommendations for legislation. Last year, December of last year, this committee put out a recommendation around ensuring that people who were in the criminal justice system took up trade, that trade boards could that they would have a chance to actually practice that trade once they got out of prison. So that resulted in legislation. And in a previous iteration of this committee, we were able to get 5 laws passed. So I want to really just lift up the significance of that work. Now, there were a number of other activities and civil rights reforms that have happened. Just want to acknowledge State Representative Roz Smith and the legislators who partnered with NAACP on the chokehold law that was passed also. There were a number of other things, but I see my time has run out and I will stop there. And I want to thank you for this opportunity. I'm looking forward to our monthly session.
Thank you, Betty. That is a very impressive list. I know there's even more. And
absolutely so more.
Hear about that in future sessions. And I'd like to take this moment. I noticed we have two more people in our Zoom room that have that one of whom is our next guest, Al Womble, who I think has been working on some of the same things that that Betty has. I know that he's been on our show when he was registering voters. So it's a big year, as you say, Betty. Thank you. And the other person that has been sitting here quietly and unusually quietly is my co-host, Paul Wearson. And Paul wanted to get in on that questioning. I guess he'll have to get in on some questioning with Al. In fact, I think he's the main questioner for Al. And so we'll say thank you very much, Betty. That was a very impressive introduction to your joining us monthly. I hope that you have so much good news every month.
Thank you, Susan. I probably won't have super good news always because, of course, this is, you know, it's a you know, we're dealing with issues that disparately affect people. So maybe not always, but I also look forward to coming back next month and talking about the legislative agenda of the NAACP and other organizations. Thank you.
Thank you, Betty.
In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio with hosts Gina McAndrews, Susan Franzen, and Paul Wearson. Since we are in the middle of our fall fund drive, we have collected endorsements from some distinguished people who support KHOI and Community Radio. One of these is Nicholas Johnson, who is a former FCC commissioner who is an advocate for public broadcasting and was helped write some of the important legislation on that a few decades ago and has been involved as a lawyer in the University of Iowa. He spoke with us last week, and here's what he said about donating to KHOI.
I'm Nicholas Johnson, and I'm thankful for independent community radio stations. And I'm thankful for the people who donate money to your station. Yeah. To donate to KHOI, which I certainly hope you will do. You have an obligation to, as a responsible citizen who is listening to the station, and to encourage others to listen and to donate. And you can do that by going to khoifm.org. Write down khoifm.org. Don't send more than you can afford. If it's going to result in you're not having food on the table or being evicted from your home, but send as much as you can afford. And you know what that is, and you know that's something. And every bit really does help the station right now.
Closer to home, I'd like to turn to my longtime co-host, Paul Wearson, and ask how you feel, Paul, about KHOI now that you know it mostly as a listener rather than radio host and adventurer making road trips. Because I'm looking at the screen here, I can see something that you can't, which is that Paul is not really in the Zoom room except for his voice, which, of course, that's his main thing, is his voice on the radio. And so, Paul?
Yes, Susan, I'm glad to be here. And it's a cold morning here on the farm, but that was a great guest you had from the NAACP. And I really want to chime in with the man who just spoke, because KHOI is unique in these days. This is an opportunity for everybody around here to have a real local radio station. So much of broadcasting these days is syndicated and not originating locally. And KHOI is really unique in that we're a very local station that covers local issues and has all kinds of broadcasting that originates from volunteers who want to live their dream on the radio. Like, I always talk about Bob's 8-track garage sale. You know, here's a man who's using 70s technology. We all remember, if we're old enough, the 8-tracks that you would plug into your slot on your car and play these 8-track recordings. And Bob collects those from all kinds of garage sales. And I think at this point, people send him all these things. And that's just one example of a person who has a show based on their interest, their dream, their passion. And anyone can do that. And we invite people to come to KHOI and contact us about doing things creative for them, being local reporters for us, too. And so we're a source of local information. There's a lot of interviews and explorations of local issues, and we cover all kinds of events in and around Story County in our listing area. And it's really time to maybe subscribe and back what we do, because we depend on the donations of our loyal listeners, as the public radio people do. And this is our annual drive, and we invite everybody to take a look at supporting KHOI. And there are various ways to do that. You can have a basic membership for $60 a year. Now, that is really a low cost to be participating. A household membership, $100. And the major donor is $1,000. Now, if you're a major donor, I think we shine your shoes for you. You know? And you can be a sustaining member and have a regular deduction from your bank account to support KHOI. And the way you do that is to get on our website, khoifm.org, and you can press that yellow membership or donate button to support KHOI. And any information you want from us, you can also call us at our number, 515-292-2878. So, oh, support KHOI. Give us an opportunity to stay on the air and be your local outlet for news, features, and all kinds of public interest. And we have some nationally syndicated shows, too. So this station has everything. We have music from polka to opera to rap. And so KHOI is a unique station, a unique outlet, and a unique entertainment and information source for you. So please support KHOI. Get on our website, khoifm.org. Press that donate button, and man, we really appreciate your support. Another happy winter morning, Susan. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, and I'm happy to do the station break. This is KHOI Community Radio, and although we are nonpartisan, and as a matter of fact, we welcome voices from both parties, so we get more Democratic ones, which is why when the Democratic Party is choosing its new state chair, our next guest called to tell us that he's running for that office. Al Womble, welcome. You've been a guest on KHOI a couple times in 2020, once during the Black Lives Matter demonstrations in Des Moines, when I believe you were instrumental in trying to keep some peace in the background on that, and once registering Black voters in October before the general election. Hi, Al. Welcome.
Good morning, Susan, and thank you so very much for having me today. Special day for me because it also happens to be my birthday this morning. So.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Yes. Al, Paul Wilson here. I'm a co-host. Happy birthday to you. And you might let us know what's coming up here. Right now, the party is electing a chair. Is that correct? Well, let us in on the scheduling there.
Yes. So the State Central Committee of the Iowa Democratic Party is going to be having its election for chair in either the second or third week of January. We are going to be setting that schedule in an upcoming State Central Committee meeting soon. And I have announced that I am running for chair of the party, and hoping to not only improve what we do as Democrats, but also to kind of just make sure that as we go across the state, we're trying to make a better life for Iowans everywhere.
So, Al, how many folks do you think will be running or applying for that position? Will there be several people vying for that role?
So far as I understand, there are going to be five different individuals, including myself, who are running for the position. I generally try to not talk about those individuals who are my opponents, because I feel it's important for me to, you know, let people know about who I am, you know, what my plans are, and why I've decided to run, and why I feel like I'm, you know, the best qualified for the job.
Well, what are some of the challenges that you see for the Democratic Party now? We read about the great urban rural divide in Iowa, and certainly I'm sure people in the party are trying to assign their attention to that prospect. What's your take on that?
Well, my take is kind of unique in the effect that, you know, I grew up mostly in urban areas and have lived mostly in urban areas like Davenport, Iowa City, Urbandale, West Des Moines. But, you know, growing up as a child, I worked on my family's farms out in Wheatland, Iowa, and Lost Nation, Iowa, both. And then as an individual who worked in construction for several years, I had a chance to visit many of the small towns throughout the entire state of Iowa. Both urban and rural areas have their unique challenges, but also have certain similarities. That if we address some of those base issues and we message for some of those base issues, it's going to be able to hit the concerns of both urban Iowa and rural Iowans. But that's not to take away from the fact that, yes, we need to make sure that we are doing better with connecting with individuals in rural Iowa. And that really starts by us going in and listening. One of the things that I've found is that when you go to particular areas and you sit around we used to be able to sit around the coffee shop together. But, you know, when you would go to a local coffee shop, there's no shortage of people who are willing to talk to you about issues. And it's not a matter of us then talking about what is the Democratic plan. It's our responsibility then to sit and listen and learn. What are they telling us that the issues are? What do they believe some of the solutions might be? And those are the things that we need to really, absorb and make sure that we use that as we move forward when it comes to, you know, connecting with rural Iowans and understanding, you know, what we need to do in those particular areas.
Yeah, I think that's a challenge, because when you look at the last election, the voting really fed an urban-rural pattern where the Republicans were dominant in rural areas and Democrats were dominant in urban areas. And so it really pointed up the divide in how people perceive the parties. And I really think that you're right. If you are either political party, it behooves you to go out into the state, see what's going on there. And, of course, I live near Story City on a farm. My career, though, was in Des Moines, so I'm very familiar with Urbandale, West Des Moines, that area.
Okay.
And, of course, with the small towns up here, you know, a lot of the main streets are vacant with the storefronts boarded up, and of course they're experiencing a population loss. And jobs are important. People say, we need jobs up here. We need employment. We need something to keep our youth living in our small towns. And that's certainly something that the party needs to speak to, right?
Yeah, you know, I believe that there are kind of five critical things that we can discuss that, you know, affect both urban and rural areas. And one of those is the creation of jobs with good benefits, access to health care, equity in education, retirement, and social justice. You know, when we look at some of the problems that face our urban centers, we look at some of the problems that face some of our rural centers, it's just what you talked about, Paul. You know, we have a loss of economic opportunities, which leads to a loss of population, which leads to a loss of tax base, which then leads to a loss in the ability to properly fund infrastructure development, economic development, and properly fund our educational systems. You know, and if we stick to messaging and talking about that with folks, and we understand, you know, the specific challenges of their area, then, you know, that's going to allow us to much better understand, well, how do we speak to these folks? How do we recruit candidates even? And, you know, how do we make sure that we help particular candidates get that messaging out there? You know, it's my belief that one of the things we also need to do with the Democratic Party is to stop preaching to the choir. You know, we often have, you know, county meetings or neighborhood meetings or things like that, where we get around together as Democrats and discuss things. But as I said, you know, some of the best lessons that I learned just as an individual who's been active in politics for a very long time is that you can sometimes get your best knowledge by talking to those individuals who aren't, you know, strictly part of your party. And you do that by making sure you focus on not talking about the party, but you talk about issues. You know, I learned a tremendous amount by going around the state of Iowa. And like I said, when you'd go to like any of your local Casey's in the morning, there's going to be a group of, you know, well, there used to be, once again, a group of older gentlemen sitting there in the morning having coffee. And if you just sit down and you talk and you listen, there's a tremendous amount of information you're going to get about what they think is going on in their area. You know, and it's those sorts of things that we need to do. We need to find those parallel organizations that have similar interests in issues that drive the Democratic Party and talk about those issues. Because what I've found in my travels throughout the state of Iowa, you know, there are a lot of people, especially younger people, you know, who aren't quite as party loyal, but they are loyal to and they are passionate about certain issues. And that's where we need to lead ourselves. The discussion of issues, not necessarily continuously beating the party drum.
Right. And I think for both parties, the real issue when it comes to legislative positions, for instance, electing people to local offices like the Iowa legislature or even city councils and county supervisors, it's who you recruit as candidates. And that's very key, because people in rural areas especially want to vote for someone they feel they know and who is appealing to them. And how does it help it that you develop strategies for recruiting candidates?
Well, once again, like I said, it's having those localized conversations. You know, who do individuals talk about themselves that is the person that is really knowledgeable, really on top of these issues, really a leader in the community? You know, you got to make sure that then you go to individuals, because, you know, whether you're talking about being a state legislator, a shoe salesman, or an auto mechanic, there's two things you need to be good at, that and that's the willingness and the ability. And I think it's, you know, making sure that you find that special mixture. And when it comes to recruiting candidates, you know, what sort of ties does that individual have to the rest of the community? You know, how many people know them just from the works that they do in their community? You know, I would say that there are quite a few people who know myself just because of my works in the community itself. So how do we then go to other areas and find out, listen, how active is this person in their community? How well do they know their friends and their neighbors and the issues that are affecting that particular area? And I think those are the things that we need to, you know, look for when we're recruiting candidates, is that, you know, community involvement, that they're known as an active person in that area.
Yeah, you have to look for people that not only are knowledgeable about the local area, but also have the facility to communicate and how to present themselves as candidates. And I'm sure the party, whether it's Democrat or Republican, is a resource for those candidates, because a lot of them might be reluctant or certainly uninformed about what you do as a candidate. So that would get into your role as a chair too, if you were elected right now.
Certainly. You know, one of the things that we want to make sure that we do is we give great candidate support. And so what that means is making sure that we give them the best information that we can in order to run for office. You know, how do we help them, you know, develop things that are going to help them with their candidacy? You know, we talk about some individuals who run that may not be as digitally or technically as proficient as others, So how do we help them with that particular aspect of their campaign and show them, you know, techniques and show them different things that are going to be helpful to them as they move forward? You know, how do they connect with fundraising? How do they make sure that they understand all the steps and processes of being a candidate? And more importantly, when we talk about this particular era of COVID, what is the best way to go about campaigning as a candidate when we still have to deal with a deadly pandemic, which has cost the lives of over 240,000 Americans?
Very true. And of course, the pandemic itself has become politicized. Very often, you can tell political affiliation by whether someone is masked in public or not, you know, because this has been a party issue also, where the national perception is that Democrats are responding to science and Republicans are more responding to the rights of individuals to make their own decisions about that. So very definitely, when you look at that, even something as universally threatening as the pandemic can also be a political issue. Don't you think, Al? Is that your observation, too?
Excuse me for breaking in, but we have a third guest who will be addressing some of these issues, who you might listen to in rural Iowa. And this is Julia McGuire, who is the vice president of the Iowa Farmers Union, and who's here to tell us about their annual convention, which will be held virtually on December 3rd to 5th. So anyone who hears about it and wants to go will be able to go. And there may not be a lot of seat caps in the room since it'll be virtual. And Julia can tell us whether you get to see all the other participants or not, or whether you'll have breakout sessions. Gina, you're the farm girl.
Yeah, we're excited to hear more about the conference.
Yeah, actually, we have two hosts today who live on farms. Don't you live on a farm, or is it just an acreage? Is
that it's 12 acres. It used to be the farmstead of this whole area, but there's only 12 acres left.
Okay. So, Gina, I'll introduce you to, and I'll introduce Julia McGuire to our audience. Hi, Julia.
Hello there. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for coming in today.
You want to tell us about your conference you have started coming up tomorrow?
Yes, I would love to. I always like talking about Farmers Union things. So, my name is Julie McGuire, and I'm a honey producer in Central Iowa. I also happen to be the vice president of the Iowa Farmers Union. So we are doing a virtual conference, and so there might be portions where we can see each other, but for the most part, everyone attending will only be able to see the speaker. Yeah, it's just kind of different, isn't it? Doing everything virtually, but
Some people get to go and they couldn't if it was.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so one of the things that we get to have, because the biggest piece of feedback, the most common theme when we asked everybody, do you want to attend virtually, was what do you want the most out of your annual convention? And it's talking to people and having access, talking to speakers. So we're able to do that. We've got a couple different ways that we can do like a kind of an old fashioned, you know, those meeting rooms that we used to have in the early days, the chat rooms. So we kind of have that where we can see each other. And I'm hosting a coffee. I think it's Friday at 8 in the morning. But the conference itself, it's broken up in the afternoons and evenings on Thursday and Friday, and then Saturday is kind of an all-day thing. And if you can't join us for those things, you can also have, we're calling it the IFU Late Show. We're going to have Chad Elliott be our musical entertainment.
That'll be great.
And we've got a big variety. We're a general farm organization, so we have a big variety of topics. In order to attend, you will need to register. And if you're not a member, when you sign up, you will become, it's called an associate member on the website. It's kind of like the friend of the family farm.
That's great. What are some of the topics that you're going to cover?
Sure. So we are going to cover climate change, getting local food into early childhood education centers. We'll talk about pesticide drift. And then we're adding, it's called Farm Crises Then and Now, kind of looking at you know, in the 80s, the crises that happened in Iowa farms then compared to what we're dealing with now. We'll also talk about some of the challenges that we're having in the local community food systems as far as producing, processing, distributing. We've got one of our board members who is a local producer. We've also got our normal regenerative agriculture things that we always love to talk about, like conservation. And then we've got ethanol. We've got discussion panel that we're going to have about equity, race equity. And then we've got great guest speakers. I mean, to me, that's the real benefit of a virtual conference is that we can get speakers that we wouldn't normally get, right? So we get to have Tom Philpott, and he writes for Mother Jones. He just had a book come out late this summer called The Perilous Bounty.
Oh, yes.
And that's all about our food system. We've got Dr. Michael Roseman on Saturday morning talking about farm family stress, trying to give us some tips how to deal with, you know, things that we're observing, how we might be able to intervene. That will have a lot of question and answer with Dr. Roseman. Also, Tom Philpott, a lot of question and answer. And then Dr. Ray Archuleta is coming to talk about soil health.
Wow, that sounds like you have lots of stuff.
But again, it's going to be kind of fun because we don't get to see each other hardly ever, you know? And so conference season is when we get, because we're not working so much, so we get to spend time talking.
Yes, that's terrific. And I'm glad you can have these little chat rooms in Zoom where you can at least have some interaction and ask some questions. And somebody, I'm guessing somebody's going to be moderating too when people have questions in the chat room for the speakers.
Yes. Yep. Everything is pretty moderated. So yeah, that's kind of the main difference, right? So it's not as spontaneous, but again, I think maybe that will lead to more thoughtful questioning. And again, yeah, we still have great access, farmers to speakers. And that's something that all of our membership really, really wanted.
Well, that's exciting because you have farmers from all kinds of backgrounds, I think, right?
We do. We have a lot of landowners who are not the operators. And then we've got a fair amount of table food producers, as well as conventional commodities and livestock producers.
Well, that's terrific. And again, that's this week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
It is. And you would have to go to our website, iowafarmersunion.org, to find out more information on that.
Okay. And we will also have that on our website. We usually have information on our speakers of the day and have links to their websites. So
yeah, we'll try to reciprocate back to you.
Oh, that's terrific. Yeah, so for anybody who's interested, the Iowa Farmers Union is having their exciting conference that has a diversity of topics this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And you can go to their website at, one more time,
yep, it's Iowa Farmers Union, all spelled out, iowafarmersunion.org.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Julia. We sure appreciate it. And hopefully we'll have you back and you can fill us in on some bee issues or honey issues or something like that.
Hey, I'd love to talk about that. Always do.
That's terrific. Well, I hope you have a great conference.
Thank you. Have a great one.
Thank you.
Spring, summer, and fall. Come.
Before we sign off, I promise to give you a little preview of the KHOI Holiday Gift Fair. Here's one for your new puppy, Gina. I haven't heard him today this morning.
Well, he's been actively behind me. I've been trying to keep my speaker muted. They get excited in the morning, and I'm going to play. And then
the item that I saw for you, in case anybody needs an idea, is there's one for your new puppy.
The Doggy Christmas.
I love the description of these. Dogs love presents, too. This is a wonderful combination of treats and toys. This is the perfect thing to give a friend who loves their dog. Or maybe you have your own four-legged best friend who will love the stocking full of dog toys and tennis balls to keep active. Treats from locally owned Treats on a Leash and on Main Street with a $20 gift certificate and a handmade cookie butter and blueberry and a gingerbread biscuit. Fill up with Buddy's biscuits and gingerbread flavor, along with a wind down with a braided American beef hide cane. Doggy heaven.
Well, that sounds like a winner. Yeah, there's really some beautiful items. There's a hand-painted glass vase and cheesecake, in case you don't need a vase. There's necklaces and jewelry and some really nice gift baskets, you know, with some candles and that would, you know, gift certificates. There's even some Central Iowa honey. So that's always a great gift. So you could buy your Christmas gifts while you're also donating to the continuation of KHOI. There is a beautiful bracelet on there that's been hand-carved. There's golfing. There is wine glasses and some great baskets that people have put together. And it's not all, you know, one type. There's one for golfing and dining, and there's another one for different varieties of teas with some local foods in it. A lot of local maple syrup and honey, and some really lovely baskets and jewelry. There's some brooches, and there's even some food in there with Rice Krispie bars and some chocolates, and there's even a World Peace basket that has a beautiful basket with some heavenly chocolate types in there. So I think there's a variety that could meet the needs of many folks if they're looking for a Christmas gift at a reasonable price. There's even a buy now price. So just go to our website at khoifm.org and you will see the link to the gifts.
Well, thank you, Gina. And just as Gina told you how to go look at it, it's right at the top of our website. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Your hosts for today have been Gina McAndrews, Susan Franzen, and Paul Wearson. Other voices you heard, Betty Andrews, Al Womble, and Julie McGuire.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with their relevant links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. KHOI Community Radio serves Story County, Iowa, as well as all of Boone County and some of Hamilton and Hardin County and North Polk and Western Marshall County. So there are a lot of towns and farms out there. Our mission is to build community through grassroots communication. We welcome all voices and celebrate diversity in our community. Please remember that your support is essential if we are to continue broadcasting. So you can consider becoming a sustaining member at $20 a month or $250 per year. We appreciate whatever you can afford. A basic membership is just $5 or a cup of coffee a month or $60 per year. You can pledge or bring a check in to down and open the door at 410 Douglas during the day. And or to be safer, you can just go to khoifm.org, where you can hit the yellow donate, become a member button.
If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends and be sure to keep on listening. Remember, your participation as a listener, as well as your generous contributions, are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.